Okay, let's unpack this. Ever tried figuring out why, say, your internet is suddenly crawling?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It's rarely just your own computer, right? Could be the router, maybe the line into the building, could even be something happening miles away.
Right, something totally out of your control, seemingly.
Exactly. These hidden connections where, a blip over here causes a problem way over there, that's kind of like the non-local dependency we're digging into today. And spotting these things is just crucial everywhere, isn't it? Like understanding how a financial wobble in one place affects markets globally, or predicting weather patterns.
Absolutely. And what's really fascinating and what this research gets at is that in so many complex systems, these far-reaching influences aren't just minor tweaks, they're often the main driver.
So different from how we maybe usually think about cause and effect, like A directly influencing B right next to it.
Exactly. Traditional methods often focus on that immediate local interaction. But when you look at how things really work, think molecules interacting or people influencing each other online, these more distant, less obvious links are often where the action is.
Okay, right. Which brings us nicely to today's deep dive. We had a listener send in a bit of a head scratcher, actually,
Oh, yeah.
a preprint titled Minimax Rate for Learning Kernels in Operators. Now, that sounds, let's be honest, pretty dense.
It has that academic ring to it for sure.
But the challenge it's tackling is something we can, I think, all grasp. How do we figure out the hidden rules of these complex systems just by looking at the data they produce?
Kind of reverse engineering the instruction manual.
Exactly. So our mission today is to pull out the key insights from this research so you, our listener, can get a handle on this cutting-edge approach without needing a PhD in math.
Right. And maybe thinking bigger picture, it connects to this idea of finding the, let's say, secret recipe that governs some complex thing we're observing.
The secret recipe. I like that.
That's where learning kernels and operators comes in. So very simply, the kernel is like the specific part of the recipe that says how one bit of the system affects another, even if they're not
Oh,
touching.
action role.
The interaction rule, exactly. And the operator is sort of the mechanism, the machine that applies that rule across the whole system to see what happens overall.
Okay.
And this research is all about finding better ways to mathematically describe and, most importantly, learn these non-local recipes just from the data we see.
So why is nailing down these recipes, these kernels, such a big deal? What kind of, real-world stuff does this actually help with?
Well, the paper gives some good examples. One is finding these non-local operators within partial differential
Okay,
equations.
PDEs. That sounds heavy again.
It does, but think about the applications. Designing new materials, maybe? You need to know how the tiny microscopic structure affects the overall strength or flexibility. That's non-local.
Ah, okay. Little changes having big system-wide effects.
Oh, precisely. Or fluid dynamics. How does a change in pressure way upstream affect the flow patterns further down? Non-local operators help model that.
Got it. So it's about seeing how bits of a system that look separate are actually sort of talking to each other under the hood.
Exactly that. And the paper also mentions image and signal processing. Think about cleaning up a noisy photo.
Okay.
The color of one pixel isn't random, right? It's related to the pixels around it, maybe even ones further away in the image structure. Learning these kernels could lead to much smarter ways to denoise images or spot patterns in complex signals.
Could you give us another concrete example from the paper itself, just to make it stick?
Sure. They talk about non-local diffusion models.
Okay.
Imagine tracking how an idea or maybe misinformation spreads through a social network.
Right. It doesn't just hop neatly from friend to friend.
Exactly. It can jump across clusters, follow unexpected paths. These models help capture those leaps. They also mentioned something called aggregation operators in mean field equations, which sounds complicated, but it's about modeling collective behavior, like a flock of birds or a school of fish moving together. Individuals react locally, sure, but there are these larger coordinated patterns emerging that's driven by non-local effects, too.
Okay, so we're trying to figure out these complex, often hidden links just by watching how the system behaves. But what makes that so darn difficult? Why can't we just see the rules?
Ah, well, that's the core challenge. How do you reverse engineer that recipe, the kernel, just from observing the outcome? Mathematically, this often boils down to something called deconvolution.
Deconvolution, like trying to unblur a blurry photo.
That's a great analogy. Or imagine listening to music recorded in a really echoey room. Deconvolution is like trying to digitally remove all that echo to hear the original clean sound.
And I'm guessing figuring out these non-local links from data is like way harder than just removing echo.
You got it. The paper really stresses that learning these kernels is what's known as an ill-posed inverse problem.
Ill-posed.
Now think back to the echo. There might be several different original sounds, maybe even different room shapes, that could all result in roughly the same echoey recording you hear.
So the end result doesn't uniquely point back to the cause.
Precisely. With these non-local systems, there can be many, many possible kernels, many different interaction rules that could plausibly explain the data you're seeing. The data alone is ambiguous. It doesn't give you one clear, certain answer about the underlying recipe.
So the data is fuzzy about the rules.
Exactly. And there's a mathematical reason for this, the paper highlights. A key tool they use, called the normal operator, is described as compact.
Compact, meaning small.
Sort of. Think of it like saving a big detail image as a really low quality JPEG. You compress it, you lose information, especially fine detail.
Right, and you can't get that lost detail back perfectly.
Exactly. This compact operator effectively squashes or smooths out the information from the kernel when producing the data we see. And that makes going backwards from the squashed data to the original detailed kernel incredibly difficult, maybe even impossible for certain parts of the kernel.
Okay, so learning these crucial, far-reaching influences is hard. It's ill-posed. The data can be misleading because information gets lost.
Yeah.
So how does this new research actually help? What's the innovation here?
Right, this is where it gets really interesting. The main methodological leap in this paper is introducing something called adaptive spectral Sobolev spaces.
Okay, whoa. Adaptive spectral Sobolev spaces. Let's break that down.
Let's try. Forget the jargon for a second. The core idea is about having a smarter, more flexible way to measure how well-behaved or smooth the kernel function is.
Smoothness. Like it doesn't have crazy jumps or spikes. It changes predictably.
Kind of, yeah. Think of smoothness not just as being literally smooth, but also about how its influence changes across different scales or frequencies. But the adaptive part is the real kicker here.
Adaptive how?
These spaces are like intelligent filters. They automatically focus on the parts of the kernel, the parts of the recipe that we can actually learn reliably from the data we have. They essentially learn to ignore the non-identifiable components.
The parts that got lost in that compression analogy. The blurry bits we can't reconstruct.
Exactly. It's like a mathematical framework that intrinsically understands, okay, based on this data and how it was generated, these are the features of the underlying rule we can be confident about, and these other features are just noise or ambiguity we can't resolve.
Okay, that sounds powerful. A tool that knows its own limits, in a way.
Precisely. And what's really neat is how they built these spaces. They cleverly combined established mathematical ideas. You've got standard Sobolev spaces, which mathematicians have used for ages to study function smoothness, and also something called reproducing kernel Hilbert spaces, or RKHS.
RKHS, I've heard that mentioned in machine learning circles.
Yeah, they're really powerful for modeling complex relationships in data. By bringing these different toolkits together, these adaptive spaces provide a really robust and versatile foundation for tackling these tricky learning problems.
So they've developed these smarter mathematical tools. What's the payoff? What's the big result they achieved using them?
The headline result, really, is establishing the minimax convergence rate.
Minimax convergence rate. Okay. Simple terms.
In simple terms, it tells us the absolute best possible speed at which any learning method could possibly hope to figure out the true kernel as we collect more and more data. It's like finding the theoretical speed limit for learning in this specific type of problem.
Fundamental limit.
Yeah.
And what do they find out about this speed limit? Does it depend on how quickly those non-local influences fade out?
Great question. They looked at two main scenarios, basically based on how fast the influence drops off with, say, distance or scale. The first is polynomial spectral decay.
Meaning the influence fades relatively slowly.
Yeah, think of it like 1 over distance squared or cubed a polynomial rate. And what's cool here is that the learning rate, the speed limit they found, actually lines up perfectly with results from related areas, things like functional linear regression and other kinds of inverse problems in statistics.
Okay, so that suggests a kind of unifying principle. There's a common speed limit when influences fade slowly, regardless of the exact setup.
It seems that way, yeah. It adds confidence that they're capturing something fundamental about learning these kinds of dependencies.
Right. And the second scenario?
The second scenario is exponential spectral decay. This is where the influence drops off much faster. Think e to the minus distance or something like that. Very rapid decay.
And presumably harder to learn from? Less signal to grab onto?
You'd think so, and it is considered a more challenging setting mathematically. But here's the kicker. This paper is actually the first to nail down the minimax rate for this exponential decay scenario.
Oh, wow. A first. And what did they find?
This is the really surprising bit, maybe the biggest aha moment in the paper. They found that the best possible learning speed, the minimax rate, doesn't depend on the specific rate of that exponential decay.
Wait, really? So it doesn't matter if it fades super fast or just moderately fast, as long as it's exponential?
Exactly. Whether it's e to the minus x or e to the minus 10x, the fundamental limit on learning speed turns out to be the same. What does matter, crucially, is the underlying smoothness of the kernel itself, as captured by those adaptive Sobolev spaces we talked about.
Huh. That is counterintuitive. So the inherent niceness or well-behavedness of the interaction rule itself is the bottleneck, not necessarily how quickly its influence vanishes at long distances.
That seems to be the implication. It suggests that focusing on understanding the fundamental smoothness properties might be more critical than getting lost in the weeds of exactly how fast the long-range effects weaken, at least for this class of problems.
Okay, so they've figured out the theoretical best possible performance. How did they actually build a method, an algorithm, that achieves these optimal rates? What's the practical tool they used?
Right. Theory is great, but you need a practical method. They developed and analyzed a specific estimator called the Tamed Least Squares Estimator, or TLSE.
Tamed Least Squares. Like regular least squares, but more disciplined.
Huh. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. You might remember least squares from basic stats, finding the line that best fits some data points. But standard least squares can be very unstable when you have this ill-posed problem. It can get thrown off by noise or those ambiguities we mentioned.
Because of those parts of the signal that got squashed or lost?
Exactly. Especially those problematic small eigenvalues that correspond to the directions where information was lost. The tamed part of TLSE involves a clever cutoff strategy.
A cutoff? Like it ignores the really unreliable bits of the data?
Essentially, yes. It carefully filters out or downweights the influence of those unstable parts of the problem associated with the small eigenvalues. It says, we're only going to trust the information coming from the more reliable components and be very cautious about the rest. This makes the TLSE much more robust and prevents it from giving wildly inaccurate results, which is a real risk with naive methods in ill-posed settings.
Okay, that makes sense. And proving that this tamed approach actually hits those optimal speed limits they calculated, that sounds technically challenging.
Oh, definitely. They had to develop some new technical machinery to make the proof work.
What were the key breakthroughs there on the technical side?
Well, they highlighted two main things. First, they needed a much sharper way to measure the sampling error.
Sampling error. That's the error just because we only see a limited amount of data, right?
Yeah.
Not the whole infinite process.
Exactly. We never have infinite data. They used a technique related to singular value decomposition, a way of breaking down matrices to get a really precise bound on how much uncertainty this limited sampling introduces, much tighter than previous bounds.
Okay, better control over the error from limited data. What was the second thing?
The second was getting a finer understanding of the behavior of the eigenvalues of the random data matrix itself. Remember, eigenvalues tell you about the dominant patterns or directions of variation in your data.
Right.
Getting precise control over how these eigenvalues behave, especially the smaller ones, even when you don't have a huge amount of data, is critical for analyzing methods like TLSE. They used a pretty sophisticated tool involving something called a relaxed Peck Bayesian inequality to achieve this.
Wow, okay. So some really advanced mathematical footwork needed behind the scenes to prove the method works as well as theoretically possible.
Absolutely. It shows how this field really blends practical algorithm design with deep theoretical analysis.
It really sounds like this research sits at the intersection of learning from real data and the fundamental mathematics underneath it all.
Completely. The paper makes a strong point about this deep connection between the statistical learning problem, you know, learning from messy finite data, and the underlying deterministic inverse problem, the idealized math problem with perfect information.
And that normal operator thing is key to both.
Yes, that operator and its properties, particularly how its spectrum decays, whether polynomially or exponentially, turn out to be central to understanding the difficulty and solvability of the problem in both the perfect information world and the real world of statistical learning from samples. Understanding that operator is key.
This has been incredibly clarifying, actually. Taking that dense title and breaking it down, it makes a lot of sense. So for you, our listener, the learner, trying to absorb all this, what are the absolute must-know takeaways from this deep dive?
Okay, let's boil it down. First, just realizing that many, maybe most complex systems rely heavily on these hidden long-range connections, these non-local dependencies. That's step one.
Right. Don't just look right next door.
Exactly. Second, learning these hidden rules purely from data is fundamentally hard. It's an ill-posed problem, meaning the data can be ambiguous. Information gets lost.
Okay. Crucial but tricky.
Third, the researchers here have made real progress. They've introduced these clever new mathematical tools, the adaptive spectral Sobolev spaces, and a robust learning algorithm, the tamed least squares estimator, TLSE, designed specifically for these challenges.
So better tools for a tough job. What else?
Fourth, they've established fundamental speed limits, the minimax rates. They tell us how fast we can possibly hope to learn these rules as we get more data, giving us a benchmark. And finding that surprising result about exponential decay was a key insight there.
Right. The smoothness being more critical than the exact decay speed sometimes.
Exactly. And finally, I think, is appreciating the deep interplay here between practical machine learning from data and the underlying theory of inverse problems. They really feed into each other.
This has been genuinely fascinating. It's pretty cool to see how people are developing these sophisticated mathematical and statistical tools to really peer into the interconnectedness of things. So maybe a final thought for you, our listener, to chew on. Mm. As we just keep gathering more and more data in practically every field imaginable, how might these kinds of methods, these ways of learning non-local rules, actually revolutionize our ability to truly understand the hidden dynamics governing the world around us?
That's a big question.
Yeah. What other areas, maybe ones we haven't even thought of, might be transformed by getting a handle on these complex long-range interactions? Something to ponder.
Definitely food for thought.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We look forward to our next exploration into the amazing world of knowledge.